Hello, and welcome to What on Earth, the podcast of the Environmental Investigation Agency, or EIA. EIA's ocean campaigners identified the growing problem of plastic pollution early on, and we're particularly proud to have helped lead the call for a new global plastics treaty to tackle the issue. We've since produced numerous insightful briefings and advice for the negotiators, who are currently hammering out the text of the treaty, and will shortly be in Nairobi for the third session of the UN's Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee, or INC3 for short. I'm Paul Newman, EIA's Senior Press and Communications Officer, and today I'm joined by our Ocean Campaign Leader Christina Dixon and Ocean Campaigner Jacob Keane-Hammerson to bring us up to date on what's been happening at the talk so far, and to look ahead to what we can expect from INC3 when it gets underway on the 13th of November. Chris, Jacob, welcome, and thanks for taking the time to share your thoughts with us.
My pleasure, Paul. Hello.
Hi, Paul. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you.
The highlight of the pre-INC period is doing
Absolutely.
These podcasts.
Hey, it's the best way to get me to understand what's going on. Chris, perhaps you could get started and give us a quick update on where negotiations for a global plastic treaty are currently at.
Yeah, absolutely. So your listeners may or may not remember, but I can just do a quick recap of where we are. So basically at UNEA last year, so in March 2022, there was a resolution adopted, which basically kickstarted the negotiations for a new plastics treaty. The agreement was that there would be 5 rounds of negotiations running up until the end of 2024. So we now find ourselves approaching the midpoint of the negotiations, which is frankly terrifying to think about. So INC3, which is coming up in early November in Kenya, is the one that we're heading to now. And so where are we? Well, I think coming out of INC1, vibes were positive, the mood was high, things were looking really good to keep on track and get the text done by the deadline of 2024. I would say the second round of negotiations in Paris were rather more explosive. And so we found ourselves witnessing a lot of procedural delays. There was quite a substantial tone shift, I could say, with more clear lines of division emerging amongst countries. We saw, for example, the emergence of the BRICS as a bit of an oppositional force, and big plastic producing countries like Saudi Arabia throwing up kind of roadblocks, particularly around procedural stuff, and a big industry presence. So I think my takeaway about where we are now is that if the message kind of wasn't received before, I think everyone is now on the same page that plastics are fossil fuels and a major threat to human health. And therefore, this is not going to be an easy treaty to negotiate, unfortunately.
Because I guess there are a lot of vested interests who want to push back and keep the money flowing in, yeah?
There certainly are.
Jacob, what else has been going on since the INC2 sessions back in May?
Yeah, Paul, quite a lot's been going on, actually, and time has whizzed by. I can't believe I'm back here speaking to you ahead of another INC. But just like last time, there was an opportunity for stakeholders and countries to make submissions to the process to inform moving forward. So this was a number of submissions on what intersessional work, so the period between the INCs, what work should be undertaken then, what the scope and principles of the treaty should be, as well as kind of what further thinking on issues that we didn't get to discuss at INC2, because as Chris mentioned, there were these delays. So there was a kind of condensed negotiating time to talk about matters of substance. So they had to open that up into the intersessional period. Other things that have been going on, there's been stakeholders putting on intersessional events. There was recently a global plastics summit, which EIA attended, and there's a lot of discussion about the treaty. There's been countries hosting intersessional convenings and discussions. And there's also been changes to the broader geopolitical landscape. You know, the membership of the BRICS has expanded to include countries like Saudi Arabia and other countries. We're looking at a different picture ahead of INC3, and we're looking forward to negotiating the big output between INC2 and INC3, which is the zero draft for the new treaty.
Excellent. So Chris, what specifically is on the table for the third round of negotiations?
So despite what I said before about the procedural delays and kind of blocking that we saw at INC2, actually the kind of main outcomes were met, which is essentially what Jacob alluded to, which was the mandate for the chair of the INC, which is currently Peru, to prepare a first draft, or a zero draft, should I say, of the new agreement. And basically that text is the basis for what we'll be talking about at INC 3. So it's not quite a first draft. It's like a sub-draft in this kind of world. So all of the options that have been discussed to date in the negotiations, either kind of formally raised during the contact group discussions or via submissions, have been collected in this text. And that was basically released, I think it was, early September now. So that is going to be the big item up for discussion, and that will take the majority of the week. And if the outcome of INC 3 is to prepare a proper first draft for INC 4, which is in Canada next year, then we need to basically get through a reading of this text and identify kind of areas of convergence, areas that might need to be struck off, and basically kind of get a sense of where countries are heading with this zero draft. There's also something kind of innocently called a one-day preparatory meeting that's also happening at the INC. And I think it would be remiss not to mention it, because it sounds innocent, a prep meeting, but actually this one-day meeting, which is happening in advance of the INC formally starting, has the potential to be quite an explosive or kind of tone-setting meeting for the rest of the week ahead, because that one-day meeting was at the request of some countries who said, actually, we want to have a space to discuss these issues of scope and principles. And so when we talk about scope, I think I'll kind of de-jargon that for the listeners. So basically, scope is essentially, you know, what the instrument is actually going to do. So there's a UNEA resolution which talks about, you know, ending plastic pollution using a life cycle approach, so covering the full life cycle of plastics. But there is an attempt by some countries to kind of minimize the scope. So they're kind of saying that we can't really negotiate what the instrument is going to do until we've decided on the scope. And in that, they're trying to say that perhaps the scope should be just on, for example, waste management and not on plastic production. So if there isn't an agreement about these kind of broad ideas of scope, scope could definitely be something that ends up holding up the negotiations. So what we'll see on day one is at this prep meeting is essentially how the rest of the week might flow. So when I think about what's on the table for that week in Nairobi, I'm thinking lots of late nights, and I'll be packing a lot of snack bars.
Who's actually taken part in this prep meeting? Is it a fairly fully representative meeting, or is it like a special interest of oil exporting countries, say?
Yeah, so it's basically, it's like everybody who's attending the INC will also be attending this prep meeting. So it's kind of like an unofficial official event that will be sort of run in the same way as the negotiations are otherwise being conducted. So it's going to be quite interesting. I think there's a lot of conversation amongst delegations around, you know, what's going to happen at that meeting. And I think it's a little bit a litmus test for the vibes for the rest of the week, and hopefully isn't going to be used as a kind of tactic to derail the rest of the negotiations.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of which, Jacob, Chris mentioned that INC 2 was somewhat hampered by procedural delays. Can you tell us a bit more about what the problems were? And I guess also, what do you think might be the biggest risk to INC 3 making good progress on the back of that?
Of course. So I'm going to try my best to make this as interesting and as simple as possible for the listeners. So what caused the delays were the rules of procedure for the negotiations. So what are the rules that the countries agreed to the negotiations that provide the kind of guardrails? So, and what it ultimately came down to was the issue of voting. So it started off with the rules of procedure that were agreed at an open-ended working group in Senegal in advance of the negotiations had one area that was left open, which was the modalities of how to vote on issues. So it was about whether or not the EU could vote as a bloc, whether each individual EU countries could vote individually. So this was left as an open question. And when the some countries that were perhaps seeking to delay the process, they started to pull at this thread. And this thread kind of unravels to, well, if we can't agree on how we're voting, can we agree if we should vote at all? And should we make decisions by consensus? And while consensus sounds like an excellent way to make decisions so every country is on board, purely making decisions by consensus means that any one country can block a decision. So ultimately, the ambition comes down to the lowest common denominator. So this issue just went on and on at INC2 about how we should vote. And the resolution was for countries to essentially agree to disagree about how the rules of voting should be applied, with some countries saying consensus must be made and be the decision making, and other countries saying voting is important, not only to be able to make decisions, but also to achieve consensus, because the sword of Damocles of the vote that hangs over really does encourage people to come to a kind of consensus middle ground decision. So really, that was the issue that blew up INC2 for several days. And when we think about what the risks are for INC3, we can certainly say that the fact that there is this constructive ambiguity, as they call it, actually doesn't solve the problem. It's been kicked down the road and can come back at any time. However, countries might be expecting that to come right back up. So when we think about what the risks for INC3 are, we need to kind of start to get in the heads and imagine if we want to be start to delay the process, what might we do? So Chris also mentioned the issue of scope and principles. And if countries can't agree on the scope, how do we start to negotiate? That presents a potential risk. And two other risks, three other risks, that I could imagine that could come up would be the zero draft isn't accepted as a basis for negotiations. A lot of countries have come out that this is a great first step, but we just don't know. And we really hope that that doesn't happen. Secondly, there is the risk of the text just becoming far too bloated for it to become a workable document for in between INC3 and INC4 for us to get from a zero draft to a first draft where we can really start looking at the text and the legal obligations of the treaty. And then finally, what's really crucial is that we get a good mandate for intersessional work. We only have two more INCs and a lot of work to get to. So we really need to agree on what we're going to do in between the meetings in Nairobi and Canada, and then on to South Korea. So the intersessional mandate is crucial, and if we don't agree that, it could really delay progress. But of course, it's important to remain hopeful, and I think everyone who is seeking to end plastic pollution is going to be pulling in the direction to make sure these risks are totally mitigated.
Thank you for that. Now, you both mentioned the zero draft, which I gather is the prospective text likely to form the basis for negotiations. Given that this is the main document up for discussion in Nairobi, how do you feel about its content, Chris?
Yeah, so I think it is a good basis for starting discussions. I think given everything that you've just heard, the chair had a really challenging task of pulling together information to populate this zero draft. There just wasn't a lot of time for substantial exchanges at INC2, meaning that he was reliant on, you know, the conversations that did take place plus the submissions. So I think that it's got, you know, all the kind of meat there. But as someone much smarter than me said, it's a document that contains all of your dreams, but also all of your nightmares, right? It's a kind of smorgasbord with an option one. An option one sounds really great, you know, strong binding control measures on, you know, reducing plastic production, for example. But then it also contains, you know, an alternative option, which is essentially, you know, voluntary in nature or completely subject to, you know, nationally determined obligations. So, you know, you have kind of on the one hand, a sort of more Montreal Protocol type obligation, or on the other hand, a more Paris Agreement style thing. And I think we're pretty much agreed at EIA and amongst civil society and many governments in the world that we really don't want a Paris Agreement for plastics. So we need to really go for the kind of option one, strong, legally binding provisions. And the zero draft does contain a lot of that content to work with. So in that regard, there's a lot that member states can now draw on to kind of flesh that out and develop a little bit more specificity when it comes to advancing to the first draft. I think from our side, when it comes to the kind of EIA priority topics, you know, we were really happy to see that there are options for controls on primary plastic production and also chemicals and polymers of concern. You know, these are kind of really critical issues without which, you know, ending plastic pollution is just just not going to be possible. So of course there's work to be done to improve that text, but the fact that it's there is a very good start. Similarly, you know, there are other things like specific language on the role of reuse systems in helping to kind of deliver some of those production reduction options. You know, that's a specific tool that can increase reuse and mean that you can ban and phase out certain plastic products and kind of replace them with reuse systems. So it's a real articulation of the kind of how of plastic production with those kind of demand side options as well. There's a standalone provision on fishing gear, which needs significant improvement and definitely needs to be moved out of the waste management section. But for us, fishing gear is a really specific problematic source of plastic pollution. And, you know, there's nowhere else in the global regulatory environment that deals with fishing gear adequately. So, you know, the plastics treaty represents a kind of once in a generation opportunity to really tackle fishing gear effectively. So if that language could be tweaked and improved, that's really great. And then, you know, there's some really good options on the trade in plastic waste, some good stuff to work with there, and also on finance, specifically the reference to a dedicated multilateral fund, which is something EIA is really keen on. At the same time, you know, there's a lot of information that's missing in the zero drafts. There's a lot that's kind of open for interpretation, specifically, you know, quite basic stuff around the actual legal structure of the document and the treaty, you know, how the treaty will actually work, you know, what are the kind of specific legal provisions or the kind of institutional setting through which these obligations will be delivered, and what is the role of the Conference of the Parties? Because, you know, similar to this terminology, you know, you might be familiar with from the climate space, you know, there'll be COPs in the future, and those COPs will be tasked with doing certain things to, for example, update guidance or, you know, update targets, manage the kind of reporting of, you know, how countries are actually doing when it comes to implementing the treaty. So that kind of role of the COP certainly needs to be clarified. But yeah, it's a pretty mad document. And I think Jacob already kind of mentioned this, but there's already quite a lot in there. And there are things that we still want to see added in there. So I think a big task for negotiators will be, how do we refine and clarify this text so that it becomes a kind of cohesive and coherent document, but also has all the necessary provisions in there that are really truly going to take us to where we need to go in terms of tackling plastic pollution across the full life cycle of plastics.
Yeah, it does seem to me, just listening to you guys, that the zero draft sounds a bit like ordering the special in a restaurant, you know, one from column A, two from column B, another from column C, depending on the appetite of the individual diners. Do you have confidence that it'll actually take us where we need to go in the negotiations, or is it such a dense, complex document full of so many alternatives, that's going to be a problem in itself?
Jacob, what do you think? I feel like I've come across as a bit of a doom monger while you're the voice of optimism. So I'd love to hear what you think about that.
No, I think fundamentally, Paul, like Chris said, the chair had a really difficult job and was really able to display the full range of views on the issues. And, you know, plastic is everywhere in our economies, in our lives. And it's a big text because there's a lot of work to do to end plastic pollution. And I really think it does provide a roadmap for how to get there. But it's going to be a lot of work to get through it, but that's what we're here to do. And we hope countries and member states are also there to do that as well. So, you know, we can get it through it, and it's going to be a big task, but hopefully we can. And I think, you know, for listeners of What on Earth and followers of EIA will be really pleased to hear from Chris is that a lot of our priorities are in there, and we'll be working very hard to make sure that they are, they're kept in there, and we can really start to address these kind of systemic issues on plastic pollution.
Excellent, thank you. So, finally, obviously, this is something you've mentioned earlier in this chat, and we've mentioned it in the past as well, is the degree of influence being exerted on the entire process by the powerful big oil lobby. And obviously, the people they represent have a vested interest in maintaining the flow of fossil fuels for the manufacture of plastic, given that the world is supposed to be moving away from burning it for energy and for powering cars with it. Do you see their lobby, their input, as being a significant problem for these talks?
Yeah, this is my keep coming back to this every podcast, Paul, but I think it's really important for us to keep an eye on this. And, you know, some of this lobbying goes on in the corridors, and but some of it goes on just in public. Like, you know, we look at the submissions process. There were submissions made by observer organizations and trade groups representing the industry, representing, you know, over 190 corporations, and many of them we don't actually know the full membership, so it could be more, that have actively made submissions that are seeking to either actively limit the scope of negotiations or focus the work downstream. And you know, this is not acceptable for people who really want a kind of plastic-free future that is non-toxic and healthy, and we have a better relationship with the materials that we're using as a planet. So it's not acceptable for us to limit the scope or call for a narrow and specific scope on waste management. It's really important that we look at the full life cycle. But I would also say, again, not to be too doom-mongering, the intrigue and interest of these actors in this process is because they can see that we are making a compelling and convincing case that we need to address plastic production to end plastic pollution, and their interest to try and limit the scope is because what environmental groups and everyday people are demanding is a kind of a new relationship with plastics that is healthy, non-toxic, and does not harm our planet, our health and biodiversity.
That's great, and a suitably optimistic note to sign off on. Chris, Jacob, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to have you both, and obviously come back afterwards and let us know how it went.
Thanks, Paul. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. I'll age probably 50 years during the next month, but yeah, I'll catch you up when I return.
Well, hopefully you have plenty of good news for us. Now, if you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, please watch this space for future episodes and check out our website at eia-international.org to find out more about our work. Thanks for joining us today, and wherever you are, stay safe out there.